Anybody relatively new here? Yes? No? So-so? Everyone's okay. Relatively new? Okay. Okay, then I'll look at you a whole lot. So I want to make sure we're connecting and following. I was requested during this visit to speak on specific chapters of Bhagavad Gita. So last night we did a little summary of chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita, most confidential knowledge. The most confidential knowledge is the relationship that we have with Krishna. Confidential knowledge is distinguishing matter from spirit, and we fall in the category of spirit, and that's confidential knowledge. More confidential is the distinction between the Supreme Soul and the individual soul, and most confidential is that loving relationship. So we discussed that. Bhakti is the loving relationship and what we do on our side and what Krishna does on his side, because it's a relationship. And today's topic is chapter 10. So it was announced last night that I would speak both today, this morning, and this evening on chapter 10. I have to do something different because it's two different classes. So today morning is, I thought, we'll be discussing the four verses in chapter 10 that make up the essence of the entire 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita. That's our topic. It's called the Chatur Shloki, four essential verses that, standing on their own, it's Bhagavad Gita. Expanded into 700, it's Bhagavad Gita. Consolidated into four, it's Bhagavad Gita in its essence. So they're sutra-like, or very terse, compact verses that I'm going to be speaking for a little under an hour, and I gave a seminar one time that was for a week, an hour and a half times seven on these four verses. So this isn't everything. That's to say, you can just start pulling things out, and you know, like any of you have made ghee wicks from balls of cotton, you know how to do that. You take a bunch, and you'll learn how much a bunch is with the right amount. And you start turning it, and turning it, and turning it, and turning it. Little ghee, not too much, and turning it, and turning it. It gets really tight, and then you have a ghee wick. Well, what makes up a ghee wick is fibers of cotton. That's all it is. And little ghee. So you can do it the other way. You can take a ghee wick and start fluffing it out and fluffing it out and fluffing it out and fluffing it out. And you get all the cotton fibers. And then do it back again. And so that's what we did for this week long thing. We just took the four verses and saw what, you know, there's this strand and there's that strand and there's this message. And here's all these wonderful messages within these four verses. And then we put them all back together again. It's really nice. If someone is not good at listening, then you'll be bored or fall asleep. So if that's the case, my apologies ahead of time. But if you listen carefully, it's really wonderful. It's a wow experience, what Krishna is presenting in these four verses. The whole of Bhagavad Gita rests on these four verses. Just a kind of side note, there's a similar set of verses in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 9, verses 29, 30, 30, and 30, 31, and 32. Those four verses are the Chatur Shloki verses of the 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. The whole Bhagavatam rests in those four verses. And similarly, what Mantra Vistarani is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's term. You take the message and you, this tarani, you expand it. Not like interpret it, but just take the strands and separate the strands, look at the strands, see how beautifully they fit together to make a tapestry. And that's the Chatur-Sloki of the Bhagavatam, and similarly the Chatur-Sloki of Bhagavad Gita. So as we discussed last night, the essence of Bhagavad Gita, its essence and its conclusion is bhakti. Essence because the other things that are described are subsets of, they're parts of bhakti. Within bhakti, it's all there. Detached work is there, knowledge is there, fixing the mind upon the Supreme is there, dhyan, meditation is there, everything is there. Right? You're fascinating, huh? Okay, so anyway. So it's the essence, and it's also the conclusion. Conclusion in the sense, like, you go up a ladder or a staircase, and one step on the staircase or one rung on the ladder leads to... The purpose of the ladder is to get up there. So even you may be down here or there. The purpose is to get to some otherwise unreachable place. So to get to the top rung, then you're the topmost system of yoga is bhakti, described directly in Bhagavad Gita. So our topic is that, the topmost system of yoga, which Krishna said in the beginning of chapter 7, he made a promise or a commitment to Arjuna. I'm going to explain how this can be done, how you can attain that. And we'll discuss this a little bit more this evening. The verses that precede in chapter 10, the verses that precede the Chatur-Sloki verses, just paraphrasing in really simple language, the initial verses, Krishna says to Arjuna, what existed, that which existed before you existed, cannot be known. You can guess. You can say, perhaps, maybe. This is what existed before we existed. But conclusively, you don't know. By sense inspection, you don't know. By reason and logic, you don't know. Someone says it's this. Someone else says, no, it's not this, it's that. Someone else says, no, it's not that, it's something else. And so it goes since time immemorial, because Krishna declares that which existed before you existed, you can't know, except for one thing. If that which existed before you existed discloses, this is what existed before you existed. And then you can know conclusively if the source that you hear is actually that which existed before you existed. So it's the search for the absolute truth. The absolute truth, by definition, according to Vedanta Sutra, is that which is the source of everything. Not only before we existed, but before anything existed, matter or spirit. Of course, spirit is eternal, but spirit is resting upon the source of spirit. So what's that source? Whatever that is, that's the absolute truth. Then there's this rhetorical question. What existed before the absolute truth existed? It's a rhetorical question because, by definition, there isn't something that existed before that existed. In fact, time is eternal and absolute truth is eternal, and everything that exists is eternally situated within the absolute truth. Like Krishna says, come on in. Like Krishna says at the end of chapter 14, um, Brahman, many people have the understanding, followers of the Vedas have the understanding that Brahman is that from which everything comes. But Krishna says he is the pratishta of Brahman. Brahmano hi, he means certainly, like emphasis. Brahmano hi pratishta aham. I am the pratishta of Brahman. Definitively. Like the rays of the sun have their basis and support in the sun. Yes? Has anyone seen some rays of the sun without the sun? No such thing. And is there a sun without sun rays? No such thing. But the relationship between the rays and the sun is that the sun is the source of emanation and the rays emanate from the source. Similarly, Brahman is an aspect of the absolute reality of which Krishna is the pratishtha, the basis and support. Just like I'm sitting in a chair, and the chair is resting on the rug, and the rug's resting on another rug, and the rug's resting on the flooring's resting on some support beams, the support beams are resting on the foundation's resting on the earth, and so forth and so on. It's just infinite regress. What's the basis and support of all of the things that are the basis and support of something else? That's the, whatever that is the absolute truth. Whatever that is. And so Krishna makes the declaration that demigods, great sages, you name it, they've inquired, they can't know because it existed before they existed. Then he declares, I'm that source. And one who knows this does something with it, one who knows it factually. So that's now, we're at the beginning of text 8. That's where the Chaturshloki verses begin, if you want to open your book. Chapter 10, text 8. Well, actually, just look at 7, because it's the word opulence or vibhuti is there. Etam vibhutim yogam cha. The title of this chapter, in English it's opulence of the absolute, in Sanskrit it's vibhuti yoga, which is the language of text 7. Towards the end of, we'll hear this evening, but at the end, the last long section of this chapter is Krishna enumerating some of his vibhutis, his opulences in this world. But his opulence in this world are based on him. These are opulences of the opulent, the potencies of the potent, the glories of the glorious. He's the source. So Krishna is saying, one who knows, is factually convinced of this opulence of mine, which is, he's knowable only by disclosure. And he discloses to one who's not envious of him. We heard that in chapter 9, right? It won't be in chapter 9, and the conclusions of, the process of bhakti and the conclusions will not be understood by one who's envious. It's a prerequisite qualification. So it's important to understand what envy is and how to overcome envy. What faith is and how to overcome being faithless. That's the condition of darkness. So how to come to the position of light. So for one who understands, one who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind, engages in unalloyed devotional service of this, there is no doubt. That's, chapter 9. One who is not envious and hears in a proper manner from the proper source what Krishna's position is, then chapter 9, unalloyed devotional service, is the byproduct. It's the result of the cause. And the cause is understanding him and we understand him, when we're not envious and we hear it from the proper source, oh, that's Krishna's position. He's the source of everything. So now, chapter 10, text 8. Each of these four verses are worth memorizing. Someone's at the door. So we can chant the verse together and invite you sometime. You'll learn these verses. Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samandita. So the translation, well, we'll just do it little by little. Aham sarvasya prabhavo. Prabhava. Prabhava. Prabhava means the source of generation. Welcome. Chapter 10, text number 8. Prabhava means the source of generation. And sarvasya means all. So our acharyas say all means everything. Matter and spirit. Krishna is the prabhava of that. He's the source of everything. And the second part says it the other way around. Everything comes from me. Like, you know, checkmate. I am the source of everything. Everything comes from me. In case you didn't get it the first time. I am the source of everything. Matak sarvam pravartate. Everything comes from me. I'm the source of everything. Everything comes from me. Then iti matva means, thus knowing, chapter 10, text 8, thus knowing, so let's remember what it says in chapter 9, when one who is envious and faithless, he won't understand. One who is not envious and faithless, with basic faith, not like blind faith, but one who hears from the right source with basic faith, then they can understand, wow, there is an absolute truth, and Krishna, aham, first person singular, is that source. And iti matva, thus knowing, what are you going to do with that? Bhajante mam. Imagine, I don't know, the governor of the state came to visit. You get a phone call. The governor of the state is going to come to the program. I don't know why they would do that, but so we would, you know, just being in their presence, it's you know, we offer honor. Or even if you don't know who that person is, if you're just being in the presence of a exceptionally pious person. I'm sure we've all had that experience. Either a very powerful person or a very pious person, something like that. And just being in their presence, there's a sense of respect, or like their presence is powerful. Something like we were discussing this morning about the Navi Yogendras, the nine sons of Rishabdev. Bharat was the eldest, and he became the king, the emperor of the world, and there were other brothers that became kings of the different continents. There was 81 other brothers that became brahmanas, qualified brahmanas, but nine of those 100 sons became topmost devotees, and they were topmost. They were totally liberated. They had powers where they could travel anywhere in this universe and beyond the universe. They were like the Kumaras, could do that, or Narada can do that. They were on that level. And one time they came to visit, just happened to be passing through a place where King Nimi was performing a yajna. And just as they entered, he didn't know who they were. He never saw them before. But just their presence, it was, whoa. He stopped the whole yajna. You don't do that, by the way. Like, you don't interrupt the yajna. He stopped the yajna and stood up and received them. And just started interacting with them because they were these awesome personalities. And so many other scriptural examples. So the idea I'm trying to convey is when one understands factually, like, you know, not theoretically, but deep, factually, Krishna's position, he's the absolute truth, that from which everything material and spiritual comes and is resting in him, he's it, he's the source. Then you engage in his devotional service. It's, unless you're dishonest, unless, you know, it's Dhritarashtra or something. Because he was so attached to his sons, he knew Krishna's position, but he couldn't act properly. Or Dhruva. When he heard from Narada about, you know, this behavior, this get back mentality, you can't reach Vishnu that way. You have to let go of it. You can't, because he's supreme pure. And Dhruva couldn't let go of it. He said, your advice is wise, but I can't follow it. I want a kingdom. Okay. Here's how you can reach Vishnu, because he's the supreme pure. You'll become purified. And he became purified of that get-back mentality and the idea of having a kingdom. Instead, he accepted the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Anyway, iti madva bhajante mam. It's just boom, boom. One engages in his devotional service. And buddha is the same root as buddhi. Those who have buddhi are the buddhas. They're intelligent. The learned persons, through that, Krishna gives that intelligence, spiritual intelligence, and bhava samandita, with great feeling, or bhava, they're feeling ecstatic, jubilant, fixed determination to do nothing else. There may have been a whole bunch of something else's. And those whole bunch of something else's just get dropped in just one thing. I mean, diversity can be there in life, but the purpose of those diverse things is one. Those of you familiar with Bhagavad Gita, you know that from chapter 2. Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha kurunandana. Nice verse. Ekeha kurunandana. The intelligence of those who are on this path is eka. Everything has one purpose. Diversity is there. And all features of life is not secular, where I do this for God and that for my family. Everything is for the Supreme. Everything. Everything. Without exception. Everything. What I eat, what I speak, what I do. My life is for the Supreme. Eke hakuna nandana. So that's buddha bhava. There's great emotion and fixed determination in all aspects of life. So that's text 8. One down and three to go in the Chatur Sloki. So let's chant text 9 together. Machita magatak prana bodayantak parasparam katayantas chamam nityam tushanti cha ramanti cha. This verse is basically describing, in addition to engaging in his devotional service, it's embellishing the exuberance and enthusiasm and internal spirit of joy and how they engage in that service. Kind of adjectives describing that devotional service. Their thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives fully devoted to my service. And they derive great satisfaction and bliss, always enlightening one another and conversing about me. Katha. So, in the regulative stage, we try to regulate the tongue, what the tongue eats and what the tongue vibrates. There's a nice verse in Rupa Goswami's teachings that says, paraphrase it, the understanding God is not easy, it's difficult. But it becomes easy if one can do one thing, control the tongue. And if one can control the tongue, the other senses can be controlled. And when the senses are controlled, the mind can be controlled. When the mind can be controlled, the mind fixed upon the Supreme, and then one can understand the Supreme. But without controlling the senses, you can't control the mind. And without controlling the tongue, you can't control the senses. So control the tongue. If you desire to know the Supreme, even a little bit, control of the tongue is necessary. And the functions of the tongue are two: making sounds and tasting. What goes out and what comes in. Real simple. So make the sound that's elevating. And the converse, the prohibition is, don't make sound that's degrading. Like we had this discussion this morning in the question and answer session in class about anger. And is anger sometimes appropriate? Because after all, sometimes people do some really bad things, and isn't it okay to be angry when people do some really dumb and bad and hurtful things? So we had a discussion about it. So anger has its place. It's short. In service to Krishna only, there's an appropriate utilization of that. Hanuman used it, Arjuna used it, and, you know, one can use it, but not be controlled by it. It's used in service and put away, like a sword. It stays in your sheath, and you don't use it unless for a religious purpose. Yoyutsavaha. When one, so anyway, dharma can be executed by a kshatriya in that way, but not like, you know, this person and that person between one friend or another, or some in the home due to familiarity, there's something and then anger. That's not okay. In service to Krishna, like Arjuna, etc., like Hanuman. So trying to control, the whole verse this morning was, persons may be able to control those urges, but it's temporary. And all of it can evaporate at once when anger arises. The whole ocean of material faults can be crossed, but if that little water in the hoofprint of a calf, you fall into a little bit of anger, it just obliterates all of that sukriti. It becomes duskriti instead of sukriti at once, just like that. So then to avoid or to not fall into that mistake, the bhakti has to be there, because then you have shelter in the Supreme, and then there's provocation, but there's shelter in the Supreme. That didn't get created by circumstance, or can't be taken away by circumstance. So now you're in this position of shelter in the Supreme, and then it's okay, what's the proper service position in this circumstance? That's all. That it's like you don't lose your faculty of discrimination. You don't get in a reactive tit for tat mood. You consider, what's the best way to be in service to Krishna in this circumstance? So, controlling the tongue. And what Krishna is saying here is, those who are in this position of having understood him as the absolute truth, engage in devotional service. And what is that devotional service? Katayantas chamam nityam. Not sometimes, but nityam. You know, somebody bumps into them, and it's, you know, it's an opportunity to think of how to serve Krishna best. Somebody steps on your toe. An opportunity to think of how to serve Krishna best. I don't know what it's like for all of you, but I can share with you what it's like for me. As a person going about in the world dressed in saffron, people don't know what that is, but they have an idea. And even their idea is like their own idea. So sometimes people ask, and I'm traveling, and they say, are you a monk? And this happened on the way coming from Los Angeles to Phoenix. The stewardess was one of those talking types. So I walked on the plane, and apparently she's from California. Apparently she knew something about devotees. She said, oh, welcome on board. You must be a monk. I said, yeah. He's like, I'm still coming on the plane. Are you a Buddhist monk? I said, no, I'm a Krishna monk. I said, oh, what's that? So I could speak about Krishna. And I sat down, and anyway, it was more of a kind of exchanges like that. Nice. But when I'm in the public, I know that people are judging the whole of the Hare Krishna movement on me. They don't know the whole Hare Krishna movement. They just see me. And, you know, my conduct is shaping their opinion. So I'm well aware of that. Including if somebody steps on my toe. It happens in airplanes. And, you know, people spill something or whatever it is. Something. So I'm very conscious that as I'm doing, like, you know, helping somebody get their luggage down from the overhead or something like that. It's natural. It's somebody that has a service mood to do something like that. You just courtesy. You do that anyways. But I'm also very conscious that it's shaping the opinion of others about here's this graying person that's helping somebody, you know, making sure that they get off the plane comfortably and all those things, all those little things. It's for me, it's part of service to Krishna. Besides being mode of goodness, polite, like, you know, doing the things that all moms teach their kids, you know, be polite. Anyone that's a parent knows all about that. And the kids know all about that. You're taught, you know, behavior, good behavior. But then it elevates it to service to Krishna behavior. Yeah? So, and then this service, so there's the regulative side of, well, we should regularly engage in studying Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and chanting our japa. That's the regulative side. But this is already, we're already at the bhava stage. Iti mat vapa jante mam buddha bhava samandita. Whoa. And so what do those people do? Katayantas chamam nityam. That's what they do. And what inside, what are they experiencing? Tushti. Satisfaction. And ramanti. Great happiness. And invite that person who's experiencing tushti and ramanti and say, would you like to do something else? What a big smile. No, thank you. I'm very happy. Very happy with... Here's another anecdotal. I mean, it fits in with the verse. One time I was flying from China through Malaysia all the way back to New York. It was like a long flight. And so, because in China you can't dress like this. You have to dress like that. You can't have hair like this. You have to have hair like that. So, I'm on the airplane dressed like that. And, you know, all the way from Malaysia to New York. Just like, I can't sleep on planes. So I planned it that I do projects. stuff I don't have time to do otherwise because I'm busy doing, like with you right now. So projects. I have, it's planned project time. So I was working on 2 or 3 projects the whole flight. And the stewardess, like 2/3 of the way through, that's a long journey, came through and said, "Who are you?" I was just dressed like everybody else. You know, who are you? Well, you can look up on the, this is my legal name. This is my name. Yeah, that is what I mean. I mean, like, I've never seen anything like this. And the other stewardesses were talking in the back, you know, you don't stop. You're just like nonstop doing something. You're really dedicated to this something. And who are you? And I said, well, it's not just dedicated to something. It's dedicated to someone. She went, wow. I'm going to tell that to the other stewardesses. She came back in several times. So, you know, and I said, well, I'm not dressed like a Hare Krishna monk, but I'm a Hare Krishna monk. And the one I'm dedicated to is Krishna, because I'm a Krishna monk. And I'm doing Krishna's service right here on your airplane. And you're very kindly taking care of all the things that we need so we can just do our service to Krishna all the time. So I thank you. And she said, wow. And then she came back again and said, tell me who you are again. So even dressed as you're dressed, I mean, you're dressed as you're dressed. You can do the same. You can instruct people by example in the workplace or in the marketplace or in whoever your life intersects with, who you are inside. It'll come out just by the qualities that you have. And katayantas chamam nityam. Maybe you heard or saw this little video of your ever well wisher. It was Prabhupada documentary, and Sally Agarwal was interviewed. The family in Butler, Pennsylvania, where Prabhupada went. Did any of you see that? Your ever well wisher. So, Sally Agarwal, you know, American lady married to Mr. Agarwal, an Indian man, and he, Mr. Agarwal, is the son of a person who Prabhupada was doing business with as a businessman. And when Prabhupada stopped being a businessman, he asked Mr. Agarwal, can you ask your son to send me an invitation? You know, for a tourist visa. So, some 8 months later, Prabhupada got a letter from Mr. Agarwal and said, this is an invitation to come to America. So Prabhupada got his his tourist visa on that basis. So he arrived in New York and went to the home of Mr. Agarwal and Sally Agarwal. They weren't following anything Vedic. They were very Americanized. And she describes, you know, Swamiji, it was so nice because although he was a saintly man, he never made us feel uncomfortable. We felt completely accepted for who we were. Never judged or never in any way uncomfortable. And then, you know, it was a miracle. Whenever Swamiji would, some conversation would be about something, in 2 sentences, he's speaking about Krishna. He did it all the time. And it was so comfortable. It was so nice. He was such a nice man. I was like, she didn't understand him the way that we understand him, but she understood he's such a nice man. You can be fully Krishna-centered and be a nice man in the eyes of, you know, a reasonable person or a nice lady and a nice student amongst your fellow students and just exemplary character and, you know, you like to talk about Krishna. That's, you know, in an appropriate and in a pleasing manner. And sometimes you don't because it's not appropriate or others won't see it as pleasing. You're discriminating, but it's something that it's inside, and what's inside is it comes out. So katayantas chamam nityam tushanti cha. And there's protection. When you're feeling tushti, you're feeling satisfied. It's like, you know, at the end of a meal, someone may come and say, would you like some more sabji? Would you like some more rice? Would you like some more chapati? It's, you know, tushti. I'm satisfied, thanks. Oh, please take. No, 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 no. Satisfied. And Ramanti. Here is some sense gratification. No. I'm very happy with my relationship with Krishna, which is started with hearing, and then it continues with tata. And then the other forms, other expressions, starting with hearing and chanting, other expressions of bhakti. So that's what this text 9, second of the two Chatur Sloki verses. In fact, so the first two are from the devotee side. What's their realization, and what's their subjective experience, and what's their behavior? That's the devotee. But then comes really confidential. It's like, what does Krishna feel? You want to look inside Krishna's heart and find out what Krishna feels when he's in the association of such a devotee? Let's go to text 10 and text 11, and he'll tell us. And then things he does in reciprocation with such devotion. He's a person too. He's a supreme person. So he has supreme feelings. And he has supreme ways of extending himself personally to those individuals. And remember, this is the essence of the whole Bhagavad Gita, these four verses. Let's go on to text number 10. Tesham satata yuktanam vajatam priti purvakam tadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam opiyanti te. So it starts with tesham. It's a pronoun referring to the people spoken of in text 8 and 9. Unto those. So it's an active pronoun. Unto those people. Satata yuktanam, always engaged, and both Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladev, their two principal commentators, they translate it with, like, rasa. They say, not just engaged, but what's motivating that engagement is they want to be situated in their relationship with Krishna. That's the why. So it's not just what. They're enthusiastic to always be engaged. Satata yuktanam. Always be engaged in this one thing, their relationship with Krishna. Life can be filled with diversity, no problem. Each thing, relationship with Krishna connected. Each and everything. Even sleeping, or, you know, bathing, or brushing your teeth, or driving to work, or doing your homework, or being with your family, or doesn't matter. It's like everywhere, because there's the attachment. Satata, for that relationship with Krishna. Not everything drops off the map. There's full diversity, because remember, everything comes from Krishna. You know, the carpet on the floor. The person sitting next to you. You know, the air that we're breathing. You know, you can't name something that doesn't come from Krishna. And so interacting with all those somethings with appreciation and attachment for Krishna. Tesham satata yuktanam. And now here's the quality. Vajatam priti purvakam. Priti, with great priti, love. Purvakam, complete love. Loving ecstasy, Prabhupada has translated it here. So unto those persons, tadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam opiyanti te. He gives buddhi yoga. Not something you can get at a university. It's not something you can buy a six-pack at Walmart or something. It's not something just by reading books. It's not by that. It's specifically Krishna. It's Krishna speaking, I give it. So it's different than gyan or knowledge or, you know, material intelligence. What is intelligence? Those of you that know a little bit about what IQ tests evaluate. It's simply evaluating your ability to tell this from that, because that's what intelligence is. It's discriminating this from that. You know, like a child. In the beginning stage, it's anamoya. Everything goes into the mouth. Shoe goes into the mouth. My brother's ear goes into the mouth. Whatever it is goes into the mouth. And then there's some discrimination between things that go in the mouth and things that go on your feet. And goes on your head. And, you know, there's different discriminating from animate and inanimate things. Anyway. Pranamoya. There's, you know, any. Ganamoya. Think Ganamoya. Anandamoya. There's different stages of material intelligence. This is different. This is spiritual intelligence. What kind of spiritual intelligence? How to come to Krishna. In all the different aspects of life. You know, like problem solving. We do it all the time. Should you go left or right? Or pause? What should you do? Making decisions. Dadami bodhi yogam tam yenamamo piyanti te. Krishna tells us not only, you know, go left or go right, but specifically how to reach Him. And it's from within. The metaphor that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur uses is a lotus, and Krishna is like like a bumblebee that enters the lotus of the heart and buzzes. Buzz, buzz. He gives the signal, buddhi, directly, personally, how to reach Him. The acharyas refer to the verse from the 7th chapter, yoga kshema vaham yaham, you know that verse. Ananyas chintayantamam yejana paryupasate tesham nityabhiyuktanam yoga kshema vaham yaham. Yoga kshema vaham yaham means, Krishna says, again, unto those, simile starts like this verse starts, unto those, this is what He does. Very confidential. Whatever it is that they need, He takes care of. Whatever it is that they have, He preserves. And the commentary says, wait a minute. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to do any preserving things or going and getting things. We don't have to make some endeavor like that. And Krishna's statement is, no. You just do your devotional service. And whatever it is that you require for your devotional service, I'll see that you have it. Now, we may do something. We may conduct a Janmashtami festival. And at the Janmashtami festival, we ask people, can you give a donation to the temple because it helps the temple run? And so we may do something. But it's in devotion for Krishna. That's what we do. We do our activity in devotion for Krishna. And whatever is needed, Krishna will reciprocate. And, you know, with so many other examples. We do in devotion to Krishna, but not like, you know, with our begging bowl. We know Krishna will take care, because He promises He'll take care. Where our attention goes is the quality of love with which the service is being offered. So then the detail is important, for sure. But it's not an entrepreneurial, I'll do all the, you know, ABCDs, and then Krishna's going to take care of, you know, what I need. Like He's a big vending machine. I put in the necessary coins, pull the right lever, and down comes results. No. That's devotional service isn't mechanical like that. We do our devotion based on what the previous verses are describing. And then we know, because Krishna is confirming, I'll bring them to Me. I'll give them, because they want to be with Me. I see that. I feel that. I facilitate that. I bring them to Me. Because you can't get to Krishna unless Krishna brings you to Him. And He gives the intelligence, so He guides all of your activities. All of your activities. Not just the time when you're reading Bhagavad Gita and chanting your japa. All your activities. In such a way, it takes you to Krishna. Your life becomes purified. Or Krishnaized. Fully. Everything. Everything. How does that happen? Krishna arranges it. That because it's from his side. That's the descending mercy. Now, let's look at the cowherd boys. Like, you know, pure, or the gopis, or you know, the residents of Vrindavan. They love Krishna. They don't love Krishna because, you know, he's all powerful and he'll take care of everything. They love Krishna because they love Krishna. And they can't imagine being without Krishna. I'll give an example. There are two leelas in Vrindavan where there's forest fires. And in both of them, they unsuspecting a sudden conflagration. They're surrounded by fire, and the cows are mooing, and their life is to take care of the cows. So they pray to Krishna, please rescue us and the cows. We're your dear devotees. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, it's not like they were afraid of death. And even, you know, they love the cows. They don't want the cows to be in difficulty. But they know that the cows are completely attached to Krishna. And if they can't fulfill that attachment to Krishna, it's worse than death. So please, Krishna, allow this, somehow, you're mystical, somehow rescue us so we can go on in our relationship with you. That's all. That's not a fear of death appeal. It's a relation appeal. He can't be without you appeal. They're completely attached to him, not to their safety. Their safety is in his hands. Out of their deep love for him, they have that confidence. And when the whole situation, so Krishna says, very well, close your eyes. And one of the cowherd boys says, well, wait a minute. How is just closing our eyes going to make the forest fire go away? Please explain. Another cowherd boy says, no. Krishna knows all kinds of magic and mantras, and those things have to be done when no one can see, so we have to close our eyes so we can't see it. Otherwise, it won't work. Oh, okay, we'll close our eyes. But Krishna was thinking, if they saw all this fire, whole big fire entering into my mouth, they die. They jump into the fire. And if the cowherd boys go back and they tell their parents all this fire went into Krishna's body, they give up their life. So better they don't see it. So close your eyes. He was thinking of their well-being. They were thinking of his well-being and their attachment for him. And Krishna swallowed the fire. That's the nature of what's being described here. So then, the last verse. Let's chant the last verse together. Text 11. Tesham evanukam partham aham agyana jam tamaha nashayam yatma bhavasto jnana dipena basvataha. I'll read the translation. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. In Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, he expresses like this. Krishna understood Arjuna had a doubt. And here's the doubt. All right. All of this makes sense to me. That since you are now revealing that you are that source of everything, that naturally your devotee, one will engage in your service. And engaged in your service, he'll experience this wonderful happiness and bhava samandita. And situated in that way, he'll want to chant your glories. And do that in association with others and experience tushanti and ramanti. And when you see your devotee, now just summarizing, and now when you see your devotee doing like that, You give the intelligence for your devotee how they can come to you. All of that makes sense, but I have a doubt. What's that? The doubt is, how long has the living entity been implicated in material existence? For countless lifetimes. Is there not some residual tendency, even in that very wonderful, superb state, isn't there some residual tendency to again revert to those previous activities? The example is given of a bad smell. Supposing there's some rotten garbage or something else, vomit or something, and you clean the rotten garbage and the vomit is clear. There's still a residual bad smell. One time I was visiting in Singapore, and you know how they have international flights. For some reason, they have them either depart or arrive in these ungodly hours. You know, 1 or 2 in the morning. I don't know if they like torture or deliver it or something. But the flights from India leave late by the time you reach Singapore because it's later than India time. It's, you know, 2 o'clock or 1:30 or something in the morning. So we're in the taxi going to where I'm going to stay, and unlike Singapore, the roads were real quiet. Because normally it's like busy, busy. So I just commented to the driver. I said, "You must like driving at night. It's really peaceful." He was silent. And then in a very grave, solemn voice, he said, "It used to be." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Not anymore." They said, "The whole culture has changed." And he I hit his buttons. He just like let it out. He said, it regularly happens. These young people, they're totally disrespectful to older people. That culture is gone. And commonly they're at night like this, they're drunk. And they say very foul things, and they talk to each other in very foul ways, they talk to me in very foul ways, and just rowdy and loud and obnoxious. And so many times they're so intoxicated they just vomit in the back seat. And then I have to let them out, and then I clean up the vomit. It smells bad, but the odor is still lingering. So I have to stop for the night just because, you know, he said, everything has become so degraded. It's not peaceful anymore. I was really sad. And then I was thinking of this verse from Bhagavad Gita. The residual tendency, even Krishna shows all this mercy, and we're lifted out of, you know, the misfortune of implication in material existence, but still the tendency is there. So what about that? And this verse addresses that. Again, it starts with Tesham. Unto those people spoken of in the first two of the Chaturshloki verses. Anukampartam means special mercy. So beyond, above and beyond the call of duty, not because Krishna has to. He's just, it's his nature. He's loving. And he shows special mercy. People don't have to do anything to qualify themselves. Krishna, from his side, steps forward. And aham agyanajam tamaha. Very nice phrase. The syllable ja. J-A means birth, just like Janmashtami, the eighth day of the moon when Krishna appears is Janma Ashtami. So the Ja is the birth part. So Agyana Jam, Agyanaja is the due to ignorance. The place of birth, or ignorance takes birth, is, or the misdirection of life takes birth in tamaha, ignorance. Like Prabhupada's way of saying this, over and over, I heard it least 100 times during his presence. The root cause of all suffering is ignorance, tamaha. And from that tamaha comes ajnana, ignorance. And people in ignorance, because of misdirected activity, they engage in foolish things. And you can say it's just a residual tendency of so many other prior foolish things. Chasing after happiness apart from Krishna. We call it chasing the carrot. But, you know, happiness apart from Krishna, fruitive activities. I find happiness through fruitive activities. That's ajnana, ja, tamaha. The tendency for fruitive activities, we imported into the realm of devotional service. Like, you know, we want something. So we do devotional service with the same mentality that I want something. And if I don't get that something, I get impatient with Krishna or others who maybe are supposed to make sure that I get that something. And they didn't do that. So I'm upset with them. It's fruitive. Now the transcendental position is just like Prahlad Maharaj said, there's nothing between you and me, but you're the master to Lord Nrisimhadev, and I'm the servant, there's nothing else. I shared it in the morning class. Entitlement. What am I entitled to? I'm entitled to service. That's what's mine. My relationship with Krishna, that's all. My relationship is service. I'm not entitled to anything other than that. And no one can take that away from me either. Someone can take away, like Haridas Thakur said to the Kazi, you can take my body and cut it into 1,000 little pieces, and I'll still chant Hare Krishna. Because it's coming from the soul. Take the body away. It's coming from the soul. You can't take that away from me. Take the body away, but you can't take the soul and the disposition of the soul to serve Krishna away. It's not negotiable. it can't be interrupted by anything. So when the vidhis, the rules and regulations of bhakti, are meant to bring us to that stage, and when one comes to that stage, Krishna says in this verse, that residual long-standing, who knows how many millions and millions and millions and countless numbers of lifetimes of being implicated in matter, I take it away. And how do I take it away? Jnana dipena basvata. I, from within their heart, destroy that tamaha, darkness, with light. The light of transcendental knowledge. Krishna illumines from within. Trust it, because he promises. It's him. It's his nature. We're not alone. We're not alone. This is bhakti, where we're in the position of service to Krishna. Krishna loves all living entities, and especially reciprocates. This was discussed in chapter 9. He's equal to everyone, but he has especially have affection for those who have affection for him. And one of the ways he shows this affection is the residual tendency to go again, once again, into, you know, doing the dumb things of material consciousness. He illumines that with knowledge instead. So, I don't want to do that anymore. In fact, I find it abominable. Anything that's not for Krishna. Anything. Not just bad habits, but anything that's not, even good things. Helping people get their luggage off of the plane. Because it's a mode of goodness thing to do. I mean, I grew up like that. So it's natural. Then the transcendental is, you do it for Krishna. They're Krishna's part. And all those transcendental things. Each thing, not just mode of goodness, but transcendental consciousness, Krishna imparts that. And then our whole life becomes spiritualized. And any inebriety or any other kind of tendency other than pleasing to Krishna tendency, Krishna checks it. We don't have to even ask Krishna for it any more than a child has to ask, Mommy, can I have something to eat? Mommies are thinking, you know, providing something for their children. You have to be prompted. That's what mommies do. They love it. And that's their happiness. Doing things for their dependent children. That's their happiness. And it's Krishna's happiness. Also, his transcendental happiness is to take us to the position of transcendence out of the Agyanajam Tamaha through the Gyanadipenavasvata method, illuminating our hearts from within with transcendental knowledge. Okay, so that's a 1 hour summary of what could take a whole week or more of unpacking the Chaturasloki verses of chapter 10. Bhagavad Gita. And we'll take some questions and then do the whole chapter this evening. Any comments or questions? Yes. Continuing previous material involvement may remain.
Yes. So, how does one deal with that?
We rely on Krishna, that's how we deal with it. We make our efforts, and we rely on Krishna, those two things. Same question as this morning. Effort and mercy. That's how. Yes? Someone else had their hand up? No? Anything else? Yes. Not only. Mode of goodness means material. Material, by definition, means forgetful. Here's simple definition between spiritual and material. Real simple. Spiritual means remembering the connection of things with their source of emanation. Material means forgetting the connection of those things with their source of emanation. That's material. So material happiness is minus Krishna. Mode of goodness activities is, it may be in direction towards Krishna, but it's not in connection with Krishna necessarily. Like, you know, mode of goodness activity, helping the classic, helping a little old lady across the street. Mode of goodness. We help little old ladies across the street. But I may not be doing that with mindfulness of Krishna. It doesn't mean now that I'm a dhoti, I don't help little old ladies across the street. I don't give charity to people who require it. But I do that in consciousness of Krishna. Because in chapter 9, which we discussed last night, there are destinations for those who worship this way and those who worship that way. And the mode of goodness is demigod worship. Yanti deva vrata devan. Pitrin yanti pitrin vrataha. Bhutani yanti bhuteja. You go to different destinations. So, worship of the demigods, one goes to the planets of the demigods. But one who worships me goes to me. So, the person who's a devotee of Krishna, they're in unalloyed goodness. Not mixed with passion and ignorance. And part of ignorance is identification with the body. It's the soul that's engaging in Krishna's service. They're using the body and the mind that are from Krishna, in service to Krishna. Yeah.
So, based on the demigods, the Allah and the genius are both demigods?
No. They're, according to Canto 2, Srila Prabhupada's purports, he specifically identifies them as Shaktyavesh, avatars. You know the meaning? Avatar, you know the meaning. So, Shakti, avesh, specifically empowered with a potency of the Lord. Shakti, avesh, avatars. A category of the six categories. Specifically, they're empowered by the Lord's bhakti shakti, as is Narada. Explicitly empowered by the Lord's bhakti shakti. So they are also empowered by the Lord's bhakti. They deliver bhakti. Empowered to do so directly by the Lord.
So they go to Krishna.
Well, they're instruments of Krishna's or God's or Allah's or God's potency of devotion. Then there are, you know, the followers can more or less follow. That's another thing. Isn't it?
Yeah, like when my kid asked, like, the other day, like, you know, I want to get a game for Krishna. I mean, like a video game, just Krishna fighting with the things. And my little one said, Krishna is only for us. Make it God instead of Krishna. The little one was saying.
So middle one.
Trying to explain whether it was Krishna or God for good.
Okay. Okay. So if your question is whether Krishna or God, God is the post, and Krishna is his name. Unfortunately, many people use the post, the title of the post, and put somebody else in that position, like something imaginary. It's not really God. There are divisions of faith, a whole chapter in Bhagavad Gita, divisions of faith. Arjuna asks, if people don't worship you, will they worship something else? They have faith in you. Will they have faith in something else? And Krishna says, sure. According to the modes of nature. So, some persons, they worship ghosts and spirits. That's not God. And the destination is other. Some persons worship the ancestors. It's really big in India. Excuse me, in China. And some parts of India. They worship the ancestors. And they go there. Pitriloka. So, whatever is worshipable, when they use the title God, nature, says some, Prakriti. God is nature, or God is love, or God is, you know, whatever. And then they worship that, and their destination is going to be different. So now, Krishna is important because he's the supreme personality of Godhead. God is means from the Sanskrit term is Ishvara. He's a controller. So somebody's, you know, the god of highways, the Department of Highways. He's the Lord, the controlling person of the Department of Highways, of the Lord of Death. But the Lord of Death, the Yamadutas, you can explain to him like this. Maybe he knows the story. The Yamadutas were checked by the Vishnu Dutas. They went back to Yamaraj and said, what's going on? Who has ever stopped death? I thought, like, you're the supreme. Then who are these other people? And it looks like, you know, there's somebody above you, or maybe there's two gods. They say like that. There's two gods. I mean, that's a big problem, because what if the two gods disagree with one another? They say that. So what's going on? If you think we're qualified. They started like in a huff, and then they said, if you think we're qualified, please explain. He explained, no, there's one supreme God. I, the Lord of Death, am subordinate to the one supreme God. I'm simply serving him. Any power I have is from him. So someone may worship the Lord of Death, or someone may worship the sun, or someone may worship whatever they may worship, and think. In the language of the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which we discussed last night, avidhi purvakam. Now, how to put this in language so that a small boy can understand? That's what mothers are good at doing. But once the picture is there, then, oh, okay, that's why we say Krishna. Now, somebody that doesn't know Krishna, they just may know the post. So you can say God, that's fine. We know what his name is. And we know what his address is. Krishna Loka. And we know what his form is. We know what his personality is. We know what his activities are. We're not like looking down at other people that don't have that. We're just considering ourselves very fortunate. So we can refer to him as God, but we know that he's Krishna. Just like maybe you can say, some people know your dad at work. They know him as Mr. So-and-so. But at home, he's dad. You know, and sometimes you're, you know, laughing together and rolling around the floor and, you know, playing together. Or whatever it is. Because there's this intimacy. He's dad. That's dad. Now, dad goes to the office and he's Mr. So-and-so. But, you know, this is his personality. So we know him as dad. Same person. So formal and very personal. So we like the personal one. But it's okay, they can say God. We can say Krishna. And it's not like we're not contradicting each other. But it's just we like the personal exchange, isn't it? Nice being with dad and just being with dad. Here's another one, and just like little advocacy for reading Bhagavad Gita carefully. Yesterday we discussed, there's one verse in the 9th chapter where Krishna describes how he's equal to everyone. He's not friend to anyone, enemy to anyone, he's equal to everyone. So that's the super soul. That's the post aspect. And then there's the Bhagavan aspect. And the Bhagavan aspect looks at the bhakti, the love of his devotee. He smiles. And he especially reciprocates with that love. Of course, he reciprocates with everybody, even if it's enmity, like Kamsa. But, you know, that's the Bhagavan feature. And, you know, we say Krishna because that's the Bhagavan feature. And some persons don't know the Bhagavan feature. They just know this, he's the Lord of all and he's equal. He's like fair. He is. But he's also a person. And when you know the person, then love. Naturally. Not just like, you know, your honor. But, you know, first name basis. Maybe in the courtroom we still may say your honor. But we know, like, you know, John or whatever his name is. Mr. Something. We can simultaneously look at Krishna in his role as a Paramatma and think, wow. And we can look at the role of Krishna as a person and go, I love him. And we especially like the loving Krishna part. But at the same time, you know, he has this other aspect of him. Now, if you read Bhagavad Gita very carefully, especially under guidance and so forth, then these little subtleties, that it makes the message of Bhagavad Gita richer and really beautiful. And then it help you to share with your children. So you're not just imparting, you know, the value of go to the temple and pay your respects to the deity and go play over there for a while and go home. But, you know, there's something that you can pass on as the parent because it's something that you've gained. And then in the way, as the parent can share with their dependent child, you know, enrich their life. You can guide them in a way that, you know, they can attend a class in Sunday school, but maybe it goes in one ear and out the other ear. Maybe it'll stick. But if you gather that in your own heart by how you receive the message of Bhagavad Gita and live it, he'll get it. It may still be like, you know, children will be children. They'll behave, you know, playfully and things. But something will go in, because if it's inside you, it'll go, you'll transmit it. We wish, as Krishna wishes for us, we wish for our dependents to go beyond the cycle of birth and death and back to this point of goodness. We want goodness, certainly, but we want beyond the cycle of birth and death, transcendence. And that comes with love. Love comes from knowing the lovable in a very personal way. Yeah.
9.30.
Okay.
Where it says, even if a devotee commits any abominable activity,
okay,
whatever
it is.
Forgiven, yeah.
Yeah.
So, can you give me some examples of what is an abominable activity?
Sure. From our life or from Scripture? Or both?
Both.
Okay. Let's start with Scripture. Maharaj Parikshit. Decorating the sage with a dead snake. He's a sage. He's a brahmana. To be honored by the king. And he's in trance. So he didn't observe the formalities of receiving the king. So, you know, it's excusable. He didn't do the formality, but it's understandable and excusable. And what Maharaj Parikshit did was sudurachar. Very bad. Now, how are we to regard Maharaj Parikshit? According to that verse, sadhu. The behavior isn't okay. The behavior wasn't a sadhu behavior. The behavior was a durachar behavior. But the person is sadhu. Why? Majjate mama nanyabak. That's the quality of Maharaj Parikshit. Clear? Supposing, so now in our practical everyday life, we'll take somebody at work, or you know, some devotee receives word that a very near and dear relative has this calamity. They're diagnosed with terminal cancer, and they're in great pain, and you know, it suddenly went to like something. So they're in this like really imbalanced, grieving, troubled state of mind. Somebody doesn't know that. And they come and, you know, say something harsh to them. Like, you know, what's wrong with you? You were supposed to be at such and such place and take care of such and such service. And you're that kind of a person. You just, you know, and so that person explodes. Says, you know, lashes back and, whoa. Now, how are we to regard that person that received the bad news, that didn't perform in their service and got spoken to harshly and lashed back? We're to consider them saintly. The behavior, we understand the behavior, it doesn't make the behavior okay, but the person is to be considered saintly. There's some possible example. Some Prabhupada calls it circumstantial. The lapse due to, you know, unusual circumstances. And due to those unusual circumstances, they do something bad. The unusual circumstance is removed, and they're back to the normal conduct because Vajate Mamana Nibak. So that's the real test. It's two things. Unusual circumstances, and after the unusual circumstances, they're back in their normal position. They don't continue that bad behavior. Circumstantial induced. In a moment of weakness, they succumb to something. And if I spent a little bit of time thinking about it, I'm sure I can think of even some like real-time contemporary examples that are coming to mind right now. A historical one in ISKCON that comes to mind. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, who was very dear to Prabhupada. And at a certain point of time, I mean, he did like tons of service and tons of service and tons of service and tons of service. And at a certain point in time, he got a little carried away. Very competitive by nature. It's not a pure trait, but it was in his genes. Very competitive. And it became oppressive. He was, you know, disrespecting the temple presidents and taking devotees, like pulling the bus and tell the brahmacharis, you know, this temples are for people in Maya, get on the bus and be in Krishna consciousness, and stole devotees. And then the temple presidents were going, wait a minute, you know, Prabhupada set up these temples not because it's Maya, because it's for fostering Krishna consciousness, and it's totally disrespectful. And it just continued and continued and continued. So the temple presidents rebelled. They went to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada told them, stop. No more bus party. Go to China. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, if I don't do this, what am I going to do? You know, tell me, don't do anything. Why don't you just like tell me to go to China? Prabhupada said, Krishna has spoken through you. No. It was like that was a punishment. And I go to China. Krishna has spoken through you. So then he surrendered, because that's his higher nature. But something of this other spirit overcame him, and it was hurtful. It hurt temples and hurt the respect towards Tamal Krishna Maharaj. But it ended up in, you know, he went to China and started preaching in China. Because it was Mission Impossible, and he was good at Mission Impossible. But it was Durachar. But we should still regard him as saintly. Not the behavior, but the person. Okay. Anything else? Yes. Yes. Yes.
But Krishna at the same time is the
Buddha. Yes.
So how could that?
Well, that's a good question. Thank you. It's a classic one, actually. And it's part of it being a good question. The bad is the free will of the living entity. So you have free will, I have free will. Let's do it like this. I have a nice announcement at the end of the program. We're going to give everybody in the room $1 million. Cash. And you can do with it whatever you like. Thanks for coming to the program. And so each of us go out the door going, wow, it's really $1 million. Now, here's this $1 million and how are we going to use it? That's the free will of the living entity, $1 million. How are we going to use it? And we can use it for something favorable, and we can use it for something unfavorable. And studies have shown that people that win the lottery, they usually ruin their lives because they don't have the adhikar to handle all that, you know, millions of dollars. All the people that were their friends, now it's like, you know, they just want money from me. They're not my friends anymore. Anyway, so many other things happen in life. So we have this it's a very valuable asset, free will. But we're in the material world because we have an attitude toward he who is actually the enjoyer and the controller of everything, the source of everything. So it's the attitude of the living entity that takes that $1 million or the free will and misuses it. And that's what's called bad. But the source of it is free will. Now, Krishna doesn't... Krishna doesn't dictate to us how to use our free will, otherwise it's not free will. It's not like Krishna grabs us by the shirt and says, look, love me or else. And by the way, there isn't even an or else. It's only one thing. That's not love. Love means free will. So free will means we can choose something else besides loving Krishna and being in harmony with Krishna's will. That's what that is. And Krishna is the source of that. He by his sanction, in the language of chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita, these two things, upadrashta, as the super soul within, he oversees, drashta, upadrashta, he's the overseer, and anumanta, cha, and he permits, he sanctions. So, I'm a thief. And I could live an honest living, but I want to be a thief. So Krishna, from within, may say, no, no, don't be a thief. Earn an honest living, even if it's, you know, not lots. Just earn an honest living. That's what I want. I want to be a thief. I'm exercising my free will. So now Krishna is the super soul, and he, as the super soul, reciprocates with all living entities according to their regard. Their prapadyante. Yayatam mam prapadyante tangs to daiva pajamyaham. He reciprocates. So now I'm the thief. It's at night. I'm prowling around. And I get this sense from within. Here comes somebody. So I'm going to hide behind the tree or whatever it is. Okay, now they've gone. Now I can go. That's super soul. Prabhupada gives the example of the cat. The cat's in the kitchen, waits till the housewife leaves the kitchen, then she jumps on the table and drinks the milk. Super soul. Knows to wait and knows to jump and get the milk. So that's, Krishna has a part in it, but he's just reciprocating with the free will of the living entity. Now what he wants is none of that. Please come back to me. Sarvadharmam. Mam ekam sharanam. That's what Krishna wants. But he has this other function, the free will overseer and permitter. So everything comes from him. People can't do bad things unless Krishna permits. He didn't want it. Prabhupada gives the example of a state. There's a prison house, and there's a police department, and there's laws. You know, hey, I got a great idea. What's that? Let's have a state, and the first thing we're going to build is a prison house. Because we just, like, want to put people in prison. But they know there are going to be people that will abide by the law and people that won't, and so there's a prison, and there's laws, and there's law enforcement. But the purpose is to rectify this, ideally at least, rectify the law breakers so they become law abiders, so people can live peacefully together. That's what Krishna wants. But there are people that don't. And those that don't can't unless Krishna permits. That comes from Krishna. But the operative part is our free will. So we're responsible. Sadasad yoni janmasu. Again, 13th chapter. We're responsible for the good fortune and ill fortune in our lives. The good and the bad. The proper use and improper use of that $1 million. As we walk out the door, how we're going to use it. So the bad is Krishna's sanctioning the misuse of free will, the purpose of which is to bring, built within the sanctioning is some reprisal also. How to bring that person again to their proper position. And he really puts out... He sends his messengers all over the place saying, you know, live in harmony with the Supreme. He sends scriptures. He sends representatives from the spiritual world. He empowers people to deliver bhakti. He does his part, but he doesn't interfere with the free will. But, you know, so the bad is that. and the cheating of the cheats. The cheater can't cheat without Krishna giving the intelligence how to cheat. The thief how to steal without Krishna giving the intelligence how to steal. People that do bad things without the intelligence, he's the giver of that intelligence. He doesn't like it. That's misuse of free will. And at a certain point, he liberates all those souls. Like the end of Kali Yuga, Kalki avatar comes, annihilates all the living entities, the bodies, and then they're now karma free, and Satyuga begins. They got a clean slate. And they can try it all over again. It's voluntary. Regaining our natural position is fully voluntary, which means going the other direction is also an option. And that's the bad, the misfortune. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you all for coming. 1 o'clock. Time for lunch, right? You prepared lunch? Okay. A little care time? You want to...